Hey, listener, welcome to Talent Chasing, where we bring real-world stories from the fields, courts, and pitches of Major League Sports and offices of corporate talent. It's our job to amplify those hidden stories in finding, retaining, and motivating the best talent in the world. Because we all know no team exists anywhere without great talent. My name is Brian Johnson. I'm a former Major League Baseball player and scout.
I'm Jasper Spanjot. I'm a journalist and filmmaker.
And I'm Chad Soash, recruitment industry veteran. Welcome to episode number two, Chasing Jasper.
In the first episode, we delved into my story, which was a kid with a dream that persevered, had successes, had some failures, but was touched by several different people and acts of kindness along the way. Then that dream became a reality. Now it's time to delve into the story of the guy who brought all of us together for this podcast.
Guilty, man.
We thought we'd do an introductory episode for each of us, so you get to know all of us at least, right? So who's Jasper? That's the question. Who is Jasper? So where did all of this start, Jasper? And I don't mean about mom and dad. We don't need to hear the conception story, okay? Let's go beyond that. So where did this start? Where were you born, grew up, sports, that kind of stuff? Give us a little background about you.
Pooh, that's about six questions there, Chad.
Oh, I always do that.
Born in 1995, so that makes me. It was my birthday last week, so yeah, 29 now.
Oh wow!
Yeah, I was born in the south of Holland, a small village. We moved to a slightly bigger city because my dad got a job there. Interestingly enough, my dad's from the middle of Holland. My mum's from the south. They sort of met in the middle. Well, my dad got a job as an English teacher and then pretty much went on from there. Mm-hmm. Grew up in a really nice household, was always one of the smart kids in school. Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say exactly, to give you a full background story on it. But
so you were a nerd, so we can ask the nerd.
I mean, yeah, I mean, let's just put that right on the table. Yeah, I'm a bit of a nerd. I don't shy away from that.
But Holland, okay, always there are so many different terminologies like the DACH region in Europe, and dumb Americans are like, what the hell are they talking about? So Holland versus the Netherlands, are they the same? Are they exactly the same? What's the difference?
I mean, they're used interchangeably, right?
Okay.
The Holland is actually, so we've got South Holland, which is a province here as well. So, but Holland has always been around. I use them interchangeably. I don't really care. Some people get sort of fussed up about it because they're like, it's not Holland, it's the Netherlands. And I'm like, why should I care one bit what it's called?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a flat country. In French, it's called the Pays Bas, so it means a flat country. It is just flat everywhere you look.
Is that why everybody cycles everywhere?
Yeah, well, it makes it slightly easier than some Italian mountains for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's why we cycle. It's why we cycle through the rain, through the cold, through the winds. We don't care. We'll get on our bike. It's it's a mentality, but it's part of the country's DNA for sure.
Well, we'll dig a little bit more into you in a minute, but Brian just got back from Kenya. And I want to touch on this. What were you doing in Kenya, Brian?
So we went to Nairobi, Kenya, in the eastern part of the country. Uh-huh. And it was a medical missions trip. My wife is a physician. We had another physician on our team. We had an EMT. We had two nurses. Uh-huh. We had a seamstress and even a scientist. So we went with a person who had been there four times. So the idea was to build a relationship with one region, with one area, with two companies in a surrounding areas. So instead of doing the touristy thing by dropping in, doing safari and then taking off.
Yeah.
It's a sustained effort to build relationships and really try to help folks there with needs that they may have. So
how did you get involved in doing that?
So my wife knew the woman, organized the trips for 4 years. Mm-hmm. By word of mouth. My wife and Pam is the woman that organized this. So they got to talking, putting something together. My wife is like, hey, can my husband come? And she was like, it's all women. It's seven women, so it's not really a role for him.
Okay.
But over time, they developed hey, you can fit here. Hey, what if he did that? Hey, he could do this. He could do that. So I did like six different roles.
Like your college career. You played every position.
Hey, there we go. There's the connection.
Plug and play. Yeah. The ultimate utility man.
That's right. Master of none and decent at one or two. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. While Brian's trying to save the world, right? I'm in Vegas for a week and then I go to Amsterdam.
Yeah. What did you do, Chad? Yeah.
Yeah. We don't have to go through what I did. Okay. Just saying. I was in Vegas and in Amsterdam. We did have dinner though, Jasper. So it was good.
It was
good
nice.
To meet Renee, who actually, if you're looking at talent chasing on any of the platforms out there, the awesome cover art was done by Renee. So she's
yeah. She have a full credit.
Big
yeah.
Props.
Had you all met before?
Not Renee.
In person?
Not Renee, yeah.
Jasper and I met about a year and a half or so ago, face-to-face in Belgium.
See, I was kind of left out of that meeting, so I won't take it personally.
You were saving the world.
I'll wait patiently for my invitation for the next one.
Didn't have the heart to ask you to leave saving the world to go to Vegas and then go to Amsterdam. I didn't have it in my heart.
Come and have dinner with us, Brian. Yeah, forget about Africa. Yeah,
I'm so much above you all. I'll look down my nose on you and say, oh.
Well, that being said, let's get back to Jasper.
Jasper. Yep.
So grew up. We kind of have an idea of what Holland is now. Nobody cares.
I care. And I care that the French took time out to make sure everybody knew that it was flat.
Yeah, true. Yeah. It's just the French people, right? Always thinking they're better than us. Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, who takes time to think of that and the nicknames?
Only the French. Only the French.
Only the French.
Right.
So keep at it. Born, raised. What?
Yep.
What did, when you got into sports, you were fairly early, right?
Yep.
When you got into sports?
True. Yeah. I mean, I must have been like, my parents usually make the joke that I was sort of born with a ball at my feet. Well, literally, because that's one of the first presents I ever got from my grandparents. Uh-huh. So I got a ball. So they decided I was going to be a footballer. But I just loved football at a very early age. I absolutely adored it. Like I could just spend, if you just gave me a ball and you gave me a grass pitch to play on, I would be satisfied for the rest of the day. Like I would try to mimic what I saw, like, growing up, like I loved our holidays to England. So my dad was actually an English teacher, so that meant we'd go to England about four or five times a year. So every holiday, every opportunity we had, like they would ask us, like, where do you want to go? And we were always answer the same thing: we want to go to England.
Uh-huh.
And we went camping there usually, which meant like big fields. So again, give me a big field, give me a ball, and I'll be happy. So that was usually the case. As soon as we got to a place in the UK, my mum and dad would set up the tent, and I was just like, oh, there's a football there. You just run off and play your football. So yeah, that's the lucky memories I have of my childhood, just running around on all these different fields around Europe, just playing football. I still love the game today. I stopped playing about 16, but I played organized sports football for a very long time. I think I started around 5 or 6 years old and played for about 10 years. So I still love the game today. Unfortunately, don't play anymore, but yeah. Football is a
favorite team.
Big part of it. Yeah, favorite team. I loved English football growing up. So Newcastle United was my biggest team. But like people can't imagine that now. Like the youth, they can just turn on a TV on their laptop and they can watch a game.
Yeah,
like, the first years of following my favorite teams, I had to follow like BBC Live updates where you got like, it was just text. There was nothing there. And I would stay up late at night if Newcastle won to watch match of the day on the BBC. Yeah. That was my youth. I wasn't able to watch those games live. You had to follow just by the information you were getting. But luckily now I'm able to put on a TV and can watch anytime, anywhere I want. I became quite fond of German football in the past few years. So I always sort of pivot towards Newcastle in the Premier League and FC Heidenheim in the Bundesliga. Those are probably my two favorite teams.
Very cool. If anyone's to look at your bio, you see a combination of sports,
yep,
journalism, and movie making.
True. Yeah.
I was kind of curious, and you kind of mentioned a little bit about your dad being in the academic field. Where did all those dreams come about? When did you start thinking about being a writer? Was it along the time that you were on the pitch at the same time? Did it come later, before, after? And then even to that, making movies, where did that come into play?
Right. So I need to credit my dad again, because he was also a photographer. So there were always cameras lying around my house. So every holiday we went to, I got a ball to play football and I got a camera just to run around with, and like the cheapest one, obviously, because I would break it, just to take pictures of everything. So I loved photography at a really early age. Like, I've got plenty of pictures that my dad took of me just running around taking photos of something. And storytelling wise, like, I loved football. I knew I wasn't going to be quite good enough. It was also quite clear to me that I didn't love some of the, well, I'm quite a competitive person, but some of the competitive aspects of it, I struggled with coaches in my youth that were just, well, I usually tell the story of a game that we were 3-0 up at halftime, and I'd made one really bad pass, which nearly resulted in a goal for the opposition team. And the coach came in at halftime and just completely blasted me in front of everyone. And I was like, well, I made two assists. I'm having quite a good game. Yeah, okay, sorry, my bad on the bad pass. But and then you get into the whole argument, well, you can't speak back to your coach, and you can't, well, and I was always a guy that was going to speak up if I saw some type of injustice. And I would also speak up for like teammates that got the same treatment. But I got to a certain point where I got really fed up with that. Mm. But as far as storytelling, like, I've always been fascinated by stories, just character development in all types of genres. Sports has become, well, sort of my second nature. So I feel like sports is just such a great platform to tell stories, because the highs and the lows are measured like nowhere else, right? It's like nowhere else in the world. So yeah, I mean, I love stories and I love sports. So the two sort of naturally came together when I was, looking for what on earth, what it was on earth that I wanted to do for a living. So I went into a sort of business degree to start with. And funnily enough, my mum knew it was the wrong degree for me, but she let me make my mistake anyway, which I'm grateful for in the end, because I feel like as a kid, like you can try and, well, prevent your kids from making mistakes. But I'm really fortunate in the sense that I have parents who supported me fully in whatever I decided I wanted to do. So when I decided I wanted to do that on the end of a sort of, there's a series called The Apprentice in the UK. I don't like the US version so much. wonder why. But in the UK, so I just binged that for an entire summer, and I came to the conclusion, well, I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to start a business myself. It turns out I didn't quite want to do that. I do feel like I'm a bit of an entrepreneur now, but it's crazy. It's a lot of work. So made that mistake first, then sold computers for about a year. Because I was 18, 19 and needed something to do. And then came back to what I probably was going to do anyway, study journalism. Mm-hmm. I feel like that was always going to probably be where I ended up. I just took a slightly different route to get there. My brother had also studied journalism. He'd worked in motoring journalism for a few years. So I had a great example there. I knew what the job was. And that was a study I felt far more familiar with and far more comfortable with.
Just one sibling? Just you and your brother?
Yeah, no, my sister also. So I'm the youngest of three, older brother, older sister. So plenty of people to look up to.
Well, that being said, mentoring wise, sounds like dad, Pop was like, he was a good mentor, at least a good guide. What coaches or mentors actually got you to where you are today? At almost 30.
Almost 30, yeah. I've never been one to care much about age, though. I think it's just a social construct.
No, it's actually time. Time.
Yeah, time just passing, yeah. Nothing you can do about it, too. It's just going to happen. One day I'm going to be 30, and that's going to be fine, too. Yeah.
Rough. It's rough. Rough. It's rough.
Not easy. Takes one, yeah. No, but I feel like a lot of that credit has to go to my parents. Like, I live close to them right now, and that's a conscious choice as well. I was just there earlier for a cup of tea because they've always been like, I've just such a great relationship with them, and they've sort of trusted me to make all the right decisions, and they've supported me, and they'll back me in whatever way they can. Obviously, because I'm the youngest of three, my sister will say, well, you're getting a bit of nicer treatment because, they've had to go through more stuff than me. As far as mentor wise, I mean, I have to credit my parents and also just my brother and sister who have always been there for me. Funnily enough, I've ended up working together with them as well in the past few years, just as they needed someone either who could do a video, who could write a story about something, who could do some photos. Like, I've always been trying to pride myself on doing as many jobs as possible. So yeah, I just have to credit my family for that.
Nice to have four mentors in the household.
Yeah.
But it's good to hear that brother and sister are beating you up a little bit. Keep
I have to, man. You have to stay even keeled like in life. I've always been not too high, not too low. I feel like that mentality really suits me, but it's nice to have people that can keep you grounded for sure.
Yeah. Well, let's get into your documentary making. You've made two, The Unknown Torres and Gate Money.
Yeah.
Both fascinating. You talked about before with us that the first one was kind of low budget, and but you wouldn't know it by watching it. Good. I mean, the story is great. The interviews are great. The editing and production of it is great. But the Gate Money one, secondly, taught me so much more about English football and the non-leagues and the all the different levels and the challenges of it. And for me, it is similar to minor league baseball. True. Is what I grew up with, right?
Yeah.
And so very much a connection there. But tell me more. I mean, my goodness, you must have had a lot of resistance in making Gate Money.
Oh, God, yeah.
You must have had a lot of resistance in trying to get information because there's a lot of crookedness going on and people tend to hide and obfuscate and get away and do all that. And you saw that in the film, but how much did you experience it in your work?
Yeah, I mean, I still talk to it. I work together with Fred Atkins, who's a British journalist on that film. And we still talk about it today, that with just the amount of, well, I got used to making stories that were quite feel good. So The Unknown Torres, to pivot back, that was the first full feature film I'd done. And that was just a happy story, right? It's just a happy story about this Argentinian guy who really pursued his dream and who got a lot out of it. And like everything is quite uplifting. There's a few like emotional things in there, but generally the sentiment is good. So when I was approached to do this story, I just, you delve into it, right? And there's this money scandal in non-league football. And I'd grown used to non-league football because I'd been in the UK a lot and I knew what it meant, like just semi-professional footballers. So the right back is also your local plumber, so to speak.
Sure.
And, you know, these are like community clubs. Like in the UK, unlike most countries now, sadly, the UK is still quite good in grasping that concept where a football club belongs to its community. You wouldn't say but just on the Premier League because it's like the millionaires just trying to ruin everything, in my opinion. But in non-league and in that sort of level, like there's the fans can still interact with the players. Like you can tell the striker at full time, like you did a great job. Well done on missing the penalty, but scoring two goals. Like it's still a community oriented sport there. And so what happened is during COVID, those clubs come to a standstill because these clubs rely on gate money. The money coming in from fans attending games on Saturday, 3 o'clock, coming in, spending their money, drinking a few beers, having a few chats with their friends and the players, and then going off home again. So community oriented, those clubs are struggling. So those clubs need money to survive because no one else is going to help them, right? The fans can't come in because there's a lockdown. Mm-hmm. So £10 million is sort of arranged after a few months by the British government to help these clubs. And then these clubs are like, okay, well, great. That's going to help us. Like the money that we lost by the fans not being able to attend is now going to come in and we're going to be saved for a few years. Great. So when that 10 million gets divvied up, it doesn't add up because there's certain clubs that just get way more than they probably should have done based on just calculations of how many fans attend games, etc. So you get into sort of nitty gritty of it and it's a clear story of injustice. And I've got a sort of radar for injustice. I've sort of built that up in the past few years where I hate it. I absolutely despise any form of injustice. I hated seeing kids being bullied in school. I still hate it today. Like any form of injustice will really get me wound up. My girlfriend Renee will attest to that. My parents will attest to that. Absolutely despise it. So when this happened, like clubs got hard done by. Some clubs that were counting on money just didn't get that money.
Yeah.
So we delved into it and we found out together with Fred Atkins, the journalist, we delved into it and we just quickly found out that there was a few clubs actually benefiting from this. And coincidentally, those were the clubs that belonged to the National League Board, which was the organization. National League is what the division is called.
Uh-huh.
The board that was actually in charge of the place. So then you go, well, okay, but it's still journalism, right? We try to get two sides of the story here, right? These clubs have been hard done by, they feel let down. Sure, we can tell that side of the story quite easily because they were happy to talk. Then you get into the murky side, which is, well, just an organization that doesn't want to say anything. We try every which way. The only thing we didn't do was just go with a rolling camera up to their house and be like, okay, can you please explain for yourself? Because we felt like that type of journalism didn't quite suit us. But yeah, we just got nowhere. It's like running into a brick wall, which is, I learned a lot from it as a storyteller, as a journalist, as a filmmaker, but it wasn't easy to do, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, when one side doesn't want to participate and you want to give the full story, it's incredibly hard. So you just have to go off the facts. And I thought while watching it is, I mean, we saw the same thing, and this is mainly, it was pressed by the pandemic. We saw the same thing here in the US on how, you know, the PPP loans and those types of things were actually handled. Who got money? Like Brett Favre's dumbass took a bunch of cash, like millions of dollars, when there was no reason for him to be getting money, when, you know, there were other organizations who really desperately needed that cash. That to me was interesting. One thing that's also interesting is being an American and looking at like Premier League football. So let's say, for instance, the UK Premier League, English Premier League, 20 teams, right? Yep. And that's in the UK. Now the UK is the size of a state here in the United States. Okay.
Yep.
Now let's take a look at California real quick. What are there? 3 NFL football teams in California?
Yep.
3. There's 20.
And that's just the Premier League.
Yeah. You've got the championship, right? And then you've got the ones underneath that. And Wrexham taught us all of that, Jasper.
True. Yeah. Well, Wrexham actually gave us, we were worried about that to start with, because when we were doing this story, Welcome to Wrexham came out. Uh-huh. And we were like, well, that's surely going to sort of ruin our story, because maybe they're going to draw parallels, because Wrexham was actually one of the clubs that was hard done by the original deal.
Yeah.
So we actually reached out to the original owner of Wrexham at the time, asking for an interview. He wasn't willing to participate. Later, we found out why, because the club was being sold. But yeah, I mean, England is filled with football clubs, right? It's like we've got 4 professional divisions, and then you've got like a hotbed of, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 different leagues underneath that, which are technical non-league, so semi-professional. When you go to England, I usually advise, like, please go and see a non-league football game. It'll absolutely change your mind about football. Like, I love it when you can just stand on a side, like, and you hear the players shouting at each other, and you can just be part of the actual atmosphere rather than just be a sort of a seat in a 60,000 stadium where, well, it's actually filled up mostly of tourists and people that not actually participating in creating a good atmosphere. So, if you're keen on football, go to a non-league game. That's the best part.
Yeah, and what's nice too, again, having that same experience in the minor leagues of baseball in America, is that when you're talking about these local teams, I mean, the players get an appreciation for the community, right? Yeah. And build relationships with people that are outside of the soccer world or outside of what they do. And it's a great experience, to a way to experience different parts of the country that you hadn't lived in before.
Absolutely.
But also it's an appreciation for, hey, I used to be that little kid. I used to be little Jasper in the stands looking at me. So I feel a responsibility to make sure I talk to him and sign whatever he wants.
Yeah, I mean, it's about building relationships, right? I mean, I've been to a few games of the same club where I actually took a share of the ownership, which cost me £55. Tunbridge Angels, which is all, it's all about that. I went to a few games with the who was then the chairman, Dave Netherstreet, fantastic guy who's on his pension, just running around. It's a great guy. But it's, you can just feel a sense of community there. Uh-huh. And I was only there for about 3 weeks. I attended about 3 games, and I could already sort of feel like I was getting emotionally involved, because I was starting to get to know these people. Like after the game, you can just walk up to the strikers having a pint, literally that, and just have a conversation about anything. Wow. And it's funny, because I signed the striker who played. I played quite a bit of Football Manager. It's one of my favorite games growing up. And I had actually signed the striker for a different team. So I was having a conversation with this guy who I'd signed on my laptop years earlier than that. And it was a fun conversation. We ended up talking about philosophy and all these different kinds of stuff. And he was like, oh, shit, I need to go. But that sense of community is worth a lot. it's worth far more than just being in the stands and then leaving a game and then being in the mass of people running out and running in. It's a vastly different experience.
I also love the promotion and relegation system. I wish we had that here in the States. I mean, it would give that churn. And I mean, it just, for me, it makes the system feel more fluid. We live in Portugal part of the time. And at one of our local Ferentz actually was just promoted. And I mean, that just brings more life to the area.
No, you've got a chance to be promoted. I love it about sports. I don't love it per se because I've followed teams that have been relegated in the past, and it's when Newcastle have been relegated twice in my life. But it's quite demoralizing. But at the same time, it gives you an added incentive to stay competitive because so many of these. I love baseball. We can get into the whole baseball thing, and I absolutely love Major League Baseball and Japanese baseball, but. Like when you're in the middle of the pack and it's you're trending towards September or even July and you're like in the middle of the pack and you're not really going anywhere. You can see, well, I'm a Marlins fan. So you can see, you usually see the Mets going up. You can see the Phillies going up, usually even the Nationals going up. And you can just, the Marlins would say sort of stagnant in fourth place. It was going nowhere. And you get to a point in the season where the season sort of becomes pointless, right?
Yeah.
But when that happens in European football, it doesn't happen because it stays relevant whether you're performing or not. And you're just not going to, well, it's a trade deadline. We're going to sell off all our best players. We're going to get some prospects and we'll see you guys again next year.
Yeah,
you can't do that here because you're going to get relegated and you're going to be in the second division earning lot less money. Players wouldn't want to come to you because you're not playing in the highest division. So it's not relevant. So it's big, big difference in mentality for sure.
Yeah, yeah. If you were to talk to a younger version of yourself wanting to make either one of your documentaries, what advice would you give them?
I was given great advice during the first film I did, so The Unknown Torres, which was a 90-minute feature, which is, in hindsight, just crazy doing that all by yourself because I'd written it. I was filming everything. I was doing all the interviews. I was editing everything. It was crazy.
Was that the advice? Was the advice do it all yourself?
But I love doing everything myself. So and I'm a bit of a control freak, I guess. But I think the best advice I got was during that trip where I met up with Russell Martin, who's now the manager at Southampton FC in the second division. They're probably going to get promoted at some point. He played for years. And he was like, I was running around. Like I had to go to Glasgow to film him because he was playing for Glasgow Rangers at the time.
Uh-huh.
And I was just running. And I feel like he could sense that I was just running and running and running. And he sort of grabbed me for a second. He was like, are you enjoying it? And I was like, what do you mean? Of course I'm enjoying it. I get to, you know, come up to this stadium. I get to watch games. I get to do all of this. It's my job now, so this is so much fun. It was like, yeah, I can see that you're enjoying it, but are you enjoying the process of making this? And I was like, well, I can't wait for it to be done. And he was like, but you need to remember that as soon as it's done, right? So make sure you enjoy the journey more so than the end result.
Yeah.
And that's something that I've constantly got in mind when I'm doing projects now, is where just enjoy the journey of making it rather than being so fixated on, well, it needs to be this one MP4 file that I'm going to send off to Amazon or iTunes or somewhere else, because that's going to be an empty feeling because there's really nothing at the end of that. So yeah, that's probably the advice I would give myself at an earlier stage, even because it gets you thinking about what's important, and what's important isn't finishing a job, isn't finishing that film, it's about the relationships that you build up, the places that you get to see, the people you get to talk to. That's the experience. It's not about the result.
That's amazing. And great advice for anything that we do, right?
Yeah. No, I agree.
Enjoy it. One thing that you can enjoy is being a Jets fan. I don't understand that at all.
Well,
you just said the Florida Marlins. I mean, it's like the now that, I mean,
Miami
the Jets,
Marlins.
Okay.
Yes, Miami.
It makes it better being Miami, but I mean.
I'm not sure. It's been better since their name changed.
If you visit, it makes it better. But sure, Jets, it's like you're a masochist here. What's going on?
Right.
Yeah. You can see it as this sort of self-hatred.
At least you're in good company. There's so many masochistic Jets fans. in and around New York and everywhere else. So you're in good company.
I mean, I picked a good team. That's totally fair. I don't know what it's like. I could watch any game, right? Any game. And I had this with my friend the other day. We were watching a game of football. We watch Bundesliga together. We were putting a game on. The game had finished. And he was like, okay, put on something else. Just put anything else. We got to an Italian game, Serie A. And Juventus were playing Hellas Verona, and I had no affiliation with any of the teams. Yeah. But automatically, I will go, let's go Hellas Verona today. So we're in 18th place, Juventus are in second place. So I'll automatically support the underdog anywhere I can go. So same happened. I watched ESPN America. I was subscribed to that channel, and I watched a Patriots v. Jets game. Patriots were absolutely hammering the Jets. And I was like, the Jets are going to be my team then.
Jets are my guys. My guys. Yep. So that being said, are you optimistic with Rodgers coming back, or do you just think
I'm never optimistic? I'm a Jets fan. I mean, I'll try to be. I try to lure myself into optimism every year, but that applies to any team I follow. Like with the Marlins, with the Jets, you have to preseason, you have to lure yourself into a false sense of optimism, because otherwise you're just going to be depressed all year, which you're going to be depressed at the end of the year probably anyway. So you might as well, you might as well be hopeful to start with. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're tied for first place in both those teams in the offseason.
Exactly. So you're tied for first place. Yeah. But, and to be fair, the Jets have had a good offseason. I say that every year and then it all falls down after a few years, but a few games, but we'll see. I don't, but I always say this to people. It's good for your soul to support a bad team.
That's right.
Because if you get used to your team winning all the time, as soon as that stops, look at the New England Patriots fans being all miserable now. No. You've had 10 years of glory. You have not earned the right to be miserable. Like, you need a little bit of like, just stay even keeled, not too high, not too low. You can win this game, but probably not going to happen. But if it does, it's going to be all the better. Like, if the Jets were to win a Super Bowl or the Marlins win a World Series, I'll be top of the world, man. I'll be delighted because I've endured, I don't know, 20 years of horrible things happening to me. So, yeah, it's good for your soul.
It's a great point. And I like the green. I feel sorry for Jets fans. So I hope that they do well, too. And I have to say, when the Lions went 0-16 a number of years back, that's when I became a Lions fan, and now it's kind of more fun to be a Lions fan. So I can relate. But at least I live in Detroit.
True, you've got an actual reason to. Yeah,
you're not actually right around the corner from the Jets Stadium, so
not quite. No,
I don't know.
No, but luckily for globalization, you can watch any game, and you can still get riled up. You can watch all the press conferences, and you can watch. Yeah. But it's. I mean, that to me is great about living in this moment, because you can just follow a sport as if it were your local team.
Yeah. I got to say, though, Brian, that Chad and Cheese podcast, we have a fantasy football league.
Oh, God, don't bring that up.
And we pick, right, people to actually join the league, and then we talk about it on the air every week and so on and so forth. Jasper, for a couple of years, he was like begging, let me on. I am so good at this. He got waxed this year. He got waxed. And here I am. I'm like telling Joe, I'm like, no, we need some Europeans on here. This will be fun. True. And so now Jasper screwed it up for all of Europe.
I need a retry on that, because honestly, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. No, but I've grown quite good. I play fantasy baseball and football. I've won plenty of leagues, which is not everyone wins their league. I've gotten quite good at baseball in particular. But yeah, I mean, that was just a glitch in the matrix, man. I'm normally good.
I've done fantasy football a couple of times. I was awful at it. My wife did it like 4 years in a row, won twice in the league that she was in. So you won't be hearing me asking to be in your league. I don't give a damn about fantasy football.
we can do a talent chasing league. That'd be good.
That's right.
Yeah, Brian just won't participate at all.
That's fine. There's another spot for us.
Right. I'll be the critic on the side. I'll be criticizing everybody.
But I feel like fantasy football, you can get lucky. You can get really lucky and you can win. Fantasy baseball takes a much more measured approach, I feel like, especially.
And it takes forever.
I know. Yeah.
You can't have a life and be involved in fantasy baseball.
I have to set up a lineup every day. Every day. Oh. It's, yeah, I know. Yeah.
No. Just one a week is really all I need to focus on.
Right. I can do March Madness.
Yes.
I can have the computer pick my picks for me and then see if it works.
ChatGPT.
I'm in. That's it for me. I'm good like that.
I've tried March Madness. I'm horrible at it.
Computer chooses the teams. I'm in.
Imagine that. So Jasper, if companies are chasing, you said that somebody actually came to you to create, gate money, right? How do they find you? I mean, are you just out there? Were they local? Was this just a connection that you had before? How did that happen? And how do companies generally like find you or people like you other than Fiverr?
Fiverr is not no go because I need to earn a actual living. But which is we can get into all that whole debate.
The concept of Fiverr is pretty awesome.
Yeah, the race to the bottom though, right?
I know exactly. Like, oh no, I'll charge 10 euros. No, I'll charge 9. Yeah, not worth it. Right. No, so usually it's just word of mouth. Like, I've been lucky in the sense that I've not had to do a lot of acquisition myself. Mm-hmm. I've just been able to get quite lucky with companies that find me, or the Gate Money documentary I ended up doing because I'd got to know this owner of a football club through that first film, The Unknown Tourist. He actually wanted to buy the commercial rights of me for that film because he was really impressed. I obviously said no because I thought this was going to be a big hit. It turned out to do quite well. But
good.
Documentaries are niche, right? It's really niche. So
yeah. I'm a huge documentary fan. My wife is not.
Everyone wants to watch documentaries, but no one will pay for it. That's sort of the sentiment I got from when I was sort of getting into it. I spoke to quite a few British documentary makers, and I got that advice from a few people. Like, it's a lovely job, like, and everyone wants to watch it, but when's the last time you paid to go to a cinema to watch a documentary? You didn't. You don't. So that's – and then you get into the whole Netflix part of it, which is they're sort of dramatizing stories – to sort of add a layer of fiction to nonfiction, which is horrible in my opinion, because you need to have an authentic story. So yeah, I mean, I've just been lucky going from one place to another, meeting one person who knows a person who needs an article or who needs a cool video about something. I've just been quite lucky with that.
Gate Money, actually, you went down to the UK, right, to be able to go through the whole red carpet ceremony and whatnot to actually open it.
Yeah.
We're moving very quickly, or we have moved, I guess you could say, to streaming. How is that going to affect the industry, number one? And number two, how in the hell do you get your content on streaming platforms?
It's poor. That's a good question. So for both films, I've been lucky that we've been able to premiere it at different places in the UK. So we've been organizing screenings. People have paid a few pounds to get to there. We did a Q&A after all films. Like you get to talk to the people who've just watched it.
Yeah.
I got to sign autographs for the first time, which was hilarious. But it was so funny. First film I did, The Unknown Tourist, we did a premiere at the oldest cinema in Brighton, the oldest cinema in the UK, actually. We managed to sell it out, and afterwards we were selling DVDs because the British are quite still, they like a DVD to have something physical. So we produced about 500, maybe 1,000 DVDs, and we were selling them afterwards. Like, my dad was selling them, and I remember this one kid came up to me like, "Oh, you're the director of the film." And I'm like, "Yeah, I am. Can I please get your autograph?" And that was like, so that's what it feels like. We ended up spending the night like signing autographs. It's just so funny because you feel like an imposter. Yeah,
he didn't know that you were just a few years older than he was.
Yeah, and it was like, Mister. Everyone's calling me Mister, and I was like, dude, I'm like 25 or 24 at this point. Just relax. It was awesome. But to get back to your question, like, streaming is difficult because I've had to endure this with both films. Both of my ideas were like, okay, let's get this onto a platform because we want to get as many people as possible to see it. We were lucky to sell The Unknown Tourist to a company in London who are going to distribute it for us. But then that sounds great, right? Selling your film, you think, wow, this guy's done well for himself. We got £200 for that film. I'm not joking. £200. That's all.
Wow.
I know. And that wasn't because it wasn't a good film. That was just because it's impossible to get your film up to a channel and then to get some sort of revenue from that. It's so hard. And we tried Netflix, like going the Netflix route, and then you quickly find out, right, Netflix only works with a limited amount of distributors. And those are distributors that they've worked with for years. So It's like it's a machine that's already going. And you're trying to get on. It's a train and you're trying to get on. But there's no way, there's no platform. You can't get on because they're already sort of stuck with their own. These are the companies that we work with and no one else. No one from the outside can just get their film onto Netflix. Absolutely impossible. But Amazon, on the other hand, they're quite open about it. You can actually self-distribute on Amazon, which is quite easy to do. Okay. Well, you need to get all the right specs. With both films, we were lucky that we managed to distribute in a way that it got, technically, it got sold. It's Netflix has sort of made it impossible. Prime is much better because you can also just rent films there. You can buy films. Yeah. I'm a much bigger fan of that platform. Also for distributing your own books. It helps the independent storyteller who just wants to get the story out there, who doesn't want to have all these contractual obligations, who doesn't want to have all these commercial interests in their story, but just wants to get an authentic story out there. But then there's the types of Disney's, Netflix's of this world, which have made it just too hard, in my opinion.
Yeah, Jeff Bezos rules the world, but he provides some good stuff.
True.
So, I mean, last but not least for me, kind of a weird turn, but you're a big fan of World War II Japanese strategies. Now, that to me was incredibly specific because you'll see that, you know, like the Pacific and then obviously European theaters and whatnot.
Yeah.
But specifically, Japanese strategy. So what actually drew you into that? I know you have a love for Japanese baseball. Did that like draw you in? How did that happen?
So I live in a country that is obviously a big part of World War II in the sense that we got occupied by Germany. We were one of the first countries to get occupied by Germany. It only took them about 2 days because we only had two tanks, I believe. So that wasn't too hard. But I grew up on that narrative all the time. Like, I was so familiar with that narrative at that point where I was in like middle school. Mm-hmm. I guess it's called like 15, 16 years old. Uh-huh. And I just sort of got, well, okay, I know this side of the story, but what happened there, right? And it all sort of started with, well, my fascination for Pearl Harbor, that whole incident. To me, if I found it captivating that we were being told one side of the history, which was, well, okay, it's local, so it makes sense to tell that side. Mm-hmm. But I was amazed because I sort of inquired in my class at the time, like, do you guys know that what happened in Japan and on all those tiny islands was actually also part of World War II? They were like, no. Wasn't that like a separate war?
Really?
I was like, I was almost, wow. Yeah, I know. And I was almost, because you're going to get it completely different. You're accustomed to the other way around, right?
No, we're accustomed to the two front. I mean, we were in the Pacific and we were in the, you know, European
theater.
True,
because you were at both places. Yeah. But it's, for us, it's like almost as if that war, that side of war didn't exist. And I'd read the book, The Pacific, Ambrose, I believe is the writer, which was fascinating to me. And it was around that age where I read it and I just delved into that war because I found the intricacies of what happened in the Pacific so much more interesting of what happened here because Germany occupied Europe in a quite simple fashion. The Brits fought back, France fought back. Obviously, everyone tried to fight back in its own right, but they were no match. What happened in all those tiny islands in the Pacific, completely different story.
Oh, yes.
Especially just the US having to go there and having to fight on in this sort of atmosphere and a culture and a climate that they had. Like, Europe can feel familiar to an American soldier.
Right.
When you go into those Pacific islands and you get into the monsoon season, completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of started with Pearl Harbor, reading about that, watching every documentary I could find on that, and then just also being amazed by the strategies that the Japanese had opted for, and just the element of surprise in war is the biggest thing, and they just sort of managed to nail it completely with Pearl Harbor and. I just find it fascinating. So I spent the entire summer just reading about Japanese war strategies at that point.
It is an incredible story. And I locked myself onto it too. I became a non-historian, but fascinated about the whole story and how it came about for many different countries, not just the United States. But as we talked about earlier offline, I wish more of us in the world were curious about how that happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And where the mistakes were made.
Yep.
And why it's important for us to keep NATO healthy and functioning, and why it's important to make sure Ukraine is supported now. History is very important for all of us, and I'm glad that each of us at least have taken an interest in it.
Yeah, I mean like history is what is always going to teach us about what's going to happen in the future. Like, if we don't learn from history, then history is just going to repeat itself time and time again. And we've seen that so many times, even what's happening with Ukraine and Russia. I'm always amazed, but I don't find history interesting at all. I was like, yeah, but that's just because you had a boring teacher. It's actually fascinating.
Yes.
You need to try and, you know, educate yourself because it's so important.
Yeah. And you've never been occupied, or you've never been also under duress. You've never had your life at stake for the governing body that is responsible for your safety. That makes it real relevant real quick for any of us.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yep.
Agreed. Well, absolutely. And on this podcast, we talked to interesting people. This time we're talking to Jasper, so we'll kind of let that one go. But we're talking to interesting people about their history, about their background, about, you know, the actual talent, the hunt, the chase, all those things. So, you know, Jasp, we appreciate you letting it all out and your whole almost 30 years of living. Is there anything that we missed that you wanted to throw out there that's just a great story?
I don't know, guys. You think you've covered quite a bit. I don't know if you've got any more questions for me.
Yeah, we've covered quite a bit. And I think we hit all the areas that I really wanted to hit. So I think we're good.
Nice, man.
Excellent. Brian Johnson, Jasper Spandjart, and Chad Sowash. We will see you next week on Talent Chasing.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of Talent Chasing with Brian Johnson, Chad Sowash, and Jasper Spandjart. Don't forget to subscribe to Talent Chasing on your favorite podcast platform. We'll see you next time.